From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at a Christian college called Williamson College, when the college invited the author Nancy French to speak to students about loving your enemies. That's a big word, isn't it? Enemies is something we sadly hear more and more often when it comes to Americans talking about fellow Americans. It's a very divided time. The inspiration for Nancy's talk was a story she wrote last December, and what happened next was remarkable. You might have seen it described in the pages of The Atlantic by Nancy's husband, David French. Let's start with Nancy's story. She is a conservative, a longtime Republican who has written books with prominent figures like Ann Romney, Sarah Palin. She's also a survivor of sexual abuse, which came at the hands of a religious leader when Nancy was just a girl. That's why Nancy was so particularly hurt by her party's elevation of Donald Trump to the presidential nomination in 2016. And here is what she had to say in part. Quote, "Here's the truth. The GOP once was alive, but is now dead. It confuses me to hear the values preached from the podium, but ignored in real life. It feels odd to just repurpose a political party into an extension of the Trump empire without acknowledging the values which had so recently dwelled there. My party, which should have been a place of a certain set of values, now shelters an abuser. I'm thinking of this when the GOP presses against me and asks me to close my eyes just one more time," end quote. Her husband David notes that, quote, "Nancy was slightly apprehensive before the speech at the college. The last time she'd visited a local Christian college, a man rushed up to her after she had been honored in the college's chapel, got in her face, and yelled, 'F you and your husband, you're ruining America.' It was unnerving," end quote. So what did happen at the college? Well, something happened that was so confusing, so initially hurtful, and it was a series of events that looked truly vile at first, but turned out to be something entirely different. And for the Frenches, it was a lesson in how we might judge others or a moment, how we can't really know how others might be hurting. I asked Nancy French to come on the program because I'm a fan of her writing and her general disposition and her spirit. She's kind of a throwback of sorts, she and David, kind of a calm boat in rough political waters, and it's not always easy to maintain that sense of calm and grace, but they do it more often than most. And Nancy French, New York Times bestselling author, an honor to have you. Thank you for joining the program today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I want to start with a little bit of your backstory first, and then we'll talk about what happened at the college that really, I think, has a lot of people talking. You have written very openly and honestly about the sexual abuse that you suffered, and I'm not going to ask you to go into that much detail, but can you kind of summarize for our listeners what happened when you were just a girl? How old and what kind of happened to you?
Yeah, I was about 12 years old, and I went to church, you know, three times a week, like most Southerners. And at the hands of my vacation Bible school teacher, I was abused. And I sort of, you know, kept that under the radar for years and years and never talked about it until 2016, when I saw Donald Trump rising to power. And I thought that I could speak from my perspective to my fellow Republicans, and to just sort of warn them about how they're going to suffer a great deal by supporting someone who had propagated so much sexual predation. And so that was what my 2016 Washington Post piece was about.
Were you, like a lot of people at the time, Ross Douthat among them? I'm thinking of a number of prominent sort of conservative columnists and writers who were watching in 2015 into 2016 thinking, well, there's a limit to where the support for someone like this will be in the Republican Party. There's a cap on it. You know, he may win a primary or two, but he's not going to win the nomination. He certainly won't win the presidency. Did you think that early on that, sure, this is kind of a sideshow, but it doesn't have a high ceiling?
Sure. I grew up with Ronald Reagan photos on my wall. So I've been a Republican my whole life. And I remember, you know, Dan Quayle talking about family values. And I remembered that Republicans were supposed to be pro-military. I thought the moment when it would all be over was when Trump mocked John McCain as a war hero because he'd gotten caught. I thought that was it. I remember reading that and thinking, well, that was a flash in the pan. It has to be over because Republicans aren't like this. They would never go for this. But obviously I was really wrong.
And as you thought about sharing your own story of abuse publicly, I mean, look, you and David are pretty well public figures, certainly more so even now than you might have been then. But that is a tremendous risk. I mean, that is, I have not been through it. I can't relate to it. But I admire you for wanting to tell the story for the reasons that you did. Did you sort of wrestle with whether you should do that publicly?
Yes. So in fact, I was in my 40s before I started before I told anyone other than my husband about it. And so I was going to counseling for the first time, and my counselor asked me to share the story, but I didn't even feel like I could get the words out. That's how little I had progressed in my storytelling on that subject. And so my counselor said, hey, why don't you go home, jot it out on a piece of paper, bring it back the next week, and I can read it, and then you don't have to tell me. So I went home, I wrote out the story, and then I thought it was so powerful in the cultural moment to share with my fellow Republicans, I decided to publish that in the Washington Post. And so the next week I show up to my counselor's office, I hand him a copy of the Washington Post, and I was like, here's the story. And he was like, well, this is not typically how it's done, but we can work with this.
Wow.
But you can imagine I had not progressed and I had not processed that story. And so I was surprised that the article went as viral as it did. It was one of the top stories in the Washington Post for several days, and it sort of thrust me into this position that I wasn't exactly prepared emotionally to be in, but that's how it happened.
I want to talk a little bit about some of how you perceived the abuse, and then I want to talk about the reaction to your piece. You wrote, I think, really achingly, sadly, about self-blame, that you were 12 years old, you were being molested by a religious leader in your life, and you didn't really have the tools to understand what was happening or why. And can you just describe a little bit about how difficult it is understanding that it was abuse, that it was not your fault, that it wasn't something that you sort of brought on in any way at all?
Yes. So I think when you grow up in a certain sect of Christianity, as I did, you're taught so much about sexual purity and sort of this idea that's very toxic, as in if anything happens, then you're quote unquote ruined. And there are a lot of sermons about this, especially in youth group. And that sort of I swallowed that wholly. And then when I went to my counselor for the first time in my 40s to talk about various adoption issues and other life-related issues, because we have an adopted daughter and I wanted to make sure I raised her well, on the intake form, it said, have you ever been abused? And by this time, I'm in my 40s, and I recognized that it's somewhere in me recognized that that was abuse, but like I'd never called it that, and so I just checked that box. And so when I checked that box, it changed everything. It sort of made me sort of deal with the reality of what I'd experienced. And so that was how that process began. But it was years of thinking incorrectly about it and being just utterly ashamed of what had happened.
Mm-hmm. And then you share it publicly. And yes, it is one of the most popular and read stories in the Washington Post. And yet not all reaction to it was sympathetic or even appreciative, that there was some vitriol for simply telling your own truth and for how that presidential campaign was affecting you as a sexual abuse survivor. What was some of the reaction you got in various places from fellow conservatives?
Yeah, well, you know, I was prepared for people not to believe me, but even, you know, members of my hometown congregation, they almost immediately knew who the person was, and everyone in my immediate circle was very supportive and nice. But online, it was very different. Conservatives felt judged because I was saying, hey, this guy's a sexual predator. Let's pay attention to that. And that's not the message they wanted. And so they started attacking me, and some prominent writers in the conservative world characterized me as being, they said that I had seduced my pastor. So anytime that I wrote or spoke out about any subject, let's say I was speaking about Brett Kavanaugh in Time magazine, they would say things like, well, so Nancy French seduced her pastor. Why are we listening to her about the Supreme Court? And so it was very evil. It's one of the most evil things. I was not prepared for that. And so in that process, I started just noticing like what was happening online. And some people were very supportive. I mean, the overflow of love and support. And I heard from so many victims who'd never shared their stories before. And so in the process, I started like going through my mentions, and I was so hurt by the conservative writers who did this. And I decided that I was just going to, on social media, follow people who were nice. So anyone who said anything nice to me, I followed. And anyone who was critical, I just muted. And so it changed my Twitter timeline quite a bit, because it started being filled with people who had more diverse views than, you know, it had previously been.
Can you share briefly the story of Kathy Kattenberg?
So Kathy Kattenberg was one of the Twitter friends who said something nice to me, and I followed in a knee-jerk way. And it was kind. And then I noticed when my feed was being filled that she was full of vitriol towards my husband, David French, who writes for The Atlantic and The Dispatch. And everything that he said, she insulted him or complained about him. If he talked about racism or anti-Semitism or being pro-life or the Second Amendment or the First Amendment, she would really heavily criticize him in a way that was very acrimonious, and it was relentless. And so I decided not to unfollow her because she had shown kindness to me, and I needed kindness wherever I could get it. But I sort of kept her at digital arm's length. Because, you know, our family is attacked so much online, and I didn't want to get involved in anything that was related to, you know, like morally criticizing my husband. And then one day during COVID, she tweeted that she was having difficulty getting food. And as a Christian, that pricked my heart. And I know that we're supposed to do good things to help people, and that when you see a need arise and you don't help, that it's, you know, it's a problem. And so I did not want to reach out to Kathy Kattenberg. She seemed so mean. But I was just, my conscience told me that I needed to reach out to her. So I sent her a direct message, and I was like, Kathy, this is Nancy French. We followed each other back in 16. Do you have food insecurity? And she said, yes, Nancy, thank you for reaching out. Let's get on the phone. Well, that was the last thing I wanted to do. Like, no one talks on the phone anymore. Especially, I didn't even know if she was real. Like, she didn't have a profile picture. She had an image that said, I stand with immigrants. So we got on the phone. And immediately, you can tell I have this, you know, hayseed accent. And she's from New York. And we laughed at those differences. And we talked briefly about the fact that she was not a huge fan of my husband, but he must not be totally reprehensible since I called her. And I was just like, what's going on? And she said that she had not eaten food for 2 weeks other than the pancake mix in her cabinet. And I found out she was disabled. She lived in New York in a walk up. So she couldn't even leave the house during COVID, and she was susceptible to disease. And when all of the city was trying to use the Instacart grocery delivery service, hers was delayed. So she'd placed an order and spent the money, and it had been taken out of her account, but the food never came. So she had literally no way to get food. And so, you know, here I am in Tennessee, and I was like, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to figure this out. What food do you need? And so in a very sweet conversation, she started telling me like her menu, like what she needs to survive. She needed toilet paper and chimichangas from Aldi and diced tomatoes and bananas. It was just so sweet to have this conversation, and so vulnerable and horrible. And so I was like, okay, Kathy, I'm on it. I'm going to try to figure out how to get you food. So I called some Presbyterian churches in New York because I'm Presbyterian. And then I called some synagogues in New York because she's Jewish. No one could help us. I placed additional orders on Instacart. I tried to go through Amazon. I did all of that, but the food didn't come. So my relationship with Kathy, which I wanted to keep at arm's length, became more and more close. Every day we talked on the phone. And our conversations got more and more filled with despair. I even thought I was going to have to just drive to New York with a trunk of food. When I thought about calling Catherine Lopez, who writes for National Review, she's a Catholic pro-life writer. And I called Catherine and I said, here's my situation. I'm trying to get food to this person. Can you help? And she said, yes, here's a person you can call. They'll physically go, they'll shop, and they'll deliver it. So I called Kathy back and I was like, Kathy, I figured it out. And she said, oh no, Catherine Lopez is one of the same people that I troll on Twitter. You can't let her know that I'm the one you're helping. And sure enough, Kathy, who is very, very pro-choice, really disliked Catherine Lopez's views, who's very, very Catholically pro-life. And so I was like, Kathy, we're in dire straits. I won't tell Catherine Lopez, but we've got to do this. And so we did it. So on the fourth day, her doorbell rang. She got a whole load of groceries, including her chimichangas. And then within 30 minutes, the other two orders came. And so she had 24 bananas and 6 pounds of beef. And I mean, she was just overflowing with food. And she called me and she was crying and I was crying. And another evangelical pastor in Nashville named Ray Ortland heard about her diced tomato needs. And so he sent her like 30 cans of diced tomatoes. And so this evangelical pastor in Nashville and I and Catherine Lopez, who's Catholic, and Kathy, who was Jewish, we all sort of worked together. It took all of us to figure out how to do it. And that became sort of, that was the beginning of a friendship that's lasted to this day. I talked to Kathy yesterday. We talk all the time. She's lovely. She's amazing. And what I realized was she was coming from a place of hurt and she was lonely and she was disabled and she was in need. And part of her online persona was being provocative in order to draw attention to the fact that she was hurting. And at one point during our conversation, she just said, I know that there are people out there who can help. I just wish someone would knock on my door and see if I needed anything. And so I sort of did the digital equivalent of that. And when I did that, she sort of came out of the shadows. And she's one of the more lovely, intelligent people that you'll know. We read books. We read the same books. We've even watched, you know, sermons online and talked about them. She hasn't changed an inch of her beliefs, and I don't think I've changed an inch of my beliefs, but what we have done is connected in a real and intimate and sweet way. And I can honestly say I love Kathy Gattenberg.
It's an amazing story. And so when you think about loving your enemies, or however you want to phrase it, you get invited to this college that we mentioned at the outset here, and something happened there that your husband David felt compelled to write about in the Atlantic recently in a story titled A Moment of Grace in a Season of Pain. And it happened when there was a Q&A happening with the audience and someone asked you a question about your own abuse that you had suffered, the sexual abuse that you had suffered as a child. And it came off in a way that looked very aggressive and intentionally hurtful. And I'm wondering if you can describe what happened and then what happened next.
Yeah, so I normally don't speak because I'm a writer and slightly a hermit. And so when this local college asked me to go speak, I try to say yes to local events, and I did it. But I was apprehensive because I'd been shouted down before at a Christian college. And during my speech, I really didn't want to bring up my sex abuse, but I had to do it to tell the Kathy Gattenberg story. And the whole time I was scanning the audience to see if there were people who were scowling or angry. It was full of people who would be Trump supporters and maybe people who didn't like what my husband and I had been saying for the past few years, but everyone seemed to be happy. And the speech, which was supposed to be a feel-good speech, was supposed to be uplifting. And it was about loving your neighbor, not just tolerating them. And when the first person asked the question, he said, so you talk about loving your neighbor and not merely tolerating them. Does that mean you love the pedophile who abused you? And it struck me, I was so embarrassed and humiliated. And even now when I talk about it, it sort of chokes me up because I was not, like, I just wasn't ready for that. And when he said that question, a few women in the audience started yelling. Someone yelled, "Absolutely not. This is not the forum." You know, people were trying to shout him down, and I was so humiliated. I don't even think I could see. The bright lights were in my eyes, and I looked at the president of the college, and I was like, "I can't. We need another question. I can't." And I leaned back into the microphone, and I repeated the question to him just to make sure that I didn't misunderstand. And he was like, "Yeah, that's what I'm asking." And when he said that's what he was asking, I was so overwhelmed with like humiliation, and I just started crying in a probably not so glamorous way. You know, you imagine you cry like they do on TV, and you know, sort of delicately, but I was so embarrassed. So I cried and I ran off the stage. And I ran to the bathroom, and there was already a different person in the bathroom stall. She had been in the audience, and she was so triggered by what just had transpired. She was crying. I was crying. The person who came out of the stall was younger and had purple hair. And then a lady came in who was a little older than me, and she had gray braids. And all of us were victims of sexual abuse, and we were all just crying, like, what just happened? And so I said to the bathroom coalition, they were complete strangers, didn't know their names. I was like, what should I do? The whole audience is waiting for me. Should I go back in there? Should I not? And they said, well, your husband is outside the bathroom. Maybe he can advise you. So I went out to my husband, and he was like, that was purely evil. There's no excuse for that. He says, I don't know if you can go back out there, but if you can, it would be best, because you don't want that guy to win. You don't want the whole speech about civility and love to be ruined by that moment. And so I gathered up my courage. It was the most difficult thing I've had to do. I walked in, and in the auditorium, everyone was still there. Everyone had waited. By this time, like maybe 15 minutes had passed. And when I walked in, it was as silent as a morgue. Everyone looked at me like, what's going to happen next? So I ease up to the podium. The president had the mic, and the student who had asked the first question motions that he wanted the microphone back. And the whole audience sort of collectively groaned, because everyone was really angry at this person. He just ruined the night. He'd embarrassed me. And he got the microphone, and I had no idea what I was going to say in response, but I was ready for a fight. And, he took the microphone and he said, I just want to apologize. And he got very quiet. And he said, I made a mistake. I was actually asking you that question because I'm the victim of childhood sexual abuse, and I don't know how to process forgiving my abuser. And I was hoping to actually seek wisdom from you on that. And so in that moment, everything changed. The whole mood of the audience changed. Their feelings towards him changed. I looked up and I saw people crying. And at that moment, I took the microphone back, and I didn't address him at first. But what I said to the audience was, I don't know how to fix this and make this less awkward, but the church really needs to get this right. And the whole issue of Donald Trump was even in my speech, because a lot of voters in this room decided to overlook great evil. But I turned to the students and I said, I want to honor you and your story, and I appreciate you and your courage. And I want you to know the true church stands behind you. And then I looked to the audience and I said, so let's be the true church. Let's forgive. Let's take evil seriously, and let's love each other. And it was really one of the most holy moments that I've ever experienced in my life. You know, so much emotion, so much change, so much beauty, so much pain, all in like 1 hour period.
How do you think the person who asked you that question, do you think there was embarrassment at how it came off? Because everybody around you had the same conclusion. This person was just trolling you. This person was just out to hurt you. And that wasn't it at all. Do you think that the person who asked that question immediately perceived the hurt that was done, or understood that that it had really missed the target?
Yeah, because I cried immediately. I'm sure he was like, oh my gosh, what have I done? And he was so, you know, like in need. And for the past 2 years, I've been doing an investigation into a Christian camp in Branson, Missouri, that is filled with victims. And so for the past 2 years, I've been talking to sex abuse victims in the church context almost on a daily basis. And frequently, you know, my sources would disappear. I would fear for their health, for their safety. Sometimes they would be, you know, say things that were inappropriate. I myself, as a victim, I've done things that are wildly strange, like publishing in the Washington Post before I'm ready for my public voice. And so I sort of empathized with him because the damage that was done sometimes it truncates your ability to speak clearly about the abuse. And, you know, in retrospect, I'm not sure he didn't speak clearly. I might have heard in a foggy way. So, and the people in the audience might have heard in a foggy way, because everyone brings their own baggage to conversations. And so he realized that he was persona non grata when I burst into tears and people started screaming, you know, like it was, I'm sure he realized it with great trepidation. And I'm not sure if that was, it could have been the first time he shared about his abuse. But he did so very courageously. I was not it because everyone rushed me after the speech. I wasn't able to speak to him, but I did see him, you know, in an emotional conversations with other people. I don't even know his name. But he had, the courage to make it right. And I think that for sexual abuse victims, you don't have to have the courage to do everything right, 'cause you won't. But you do have the, but having the courage to maybe just say what happened and to say the truth allows the rest of the culture to sort of figure out what their posture is going to be about sexual predation and those who do it. You know, is that a deal breaker for us when it comes to presidents, you know, or is it a deal breaker to us when it comes to where to send your kids to camp? Is, you know, like, unfortunately, all these issues arise in your life, and all of us have to make decisions like that.
Talking to Nancy French, a New York Times bestselling author who is sharing her own story and I think helping a lot of people process the surprise, the shock. You know, I think about the surprise that a lot of people have. You know, my father was and has been a lifelong small C conservative, and he can't talk about politics anymore. I think he is still in shock about what has happened to his lifelong party, Nancy. And he's embarrassed. He won't talk about it. And another part of this I find deeply confusing is I cannot count now the number of houses that I have driven past that have two pieces of imagery. And one is a flag that says, and I have to edit here, F Biden or some other related vulgarity. The other is some kind of Christian imagery, a cross usually, but you know, sometimes an image of Jesus, the Virgin Mary. And I'm truly bewildered how someone could think that, you know, if Jesus were here today, he'd want to associate with an F Biden flag. Do you feel the same dissonance when you see that imagery together?
Yes, I live in the state of Tennessee, which is very Republican. All of my neighbors, a lot of my family, you know, supported Trump. It's been very disorienting. And my position was, you know, when you have to choose between the lesser of two evils, just don't choose evil. You know, you don't have to choose evil. And so a lot of people were unhappy with the two options that were presented in 2016. And I totally get that. I felt the same way. But, you know, our party had values that we said repeatedly. And I spent much of my life talking to people saying, I'm a conservative. And that means that we're pro-military. No, we're not mean. No, we're not anti-woman. No, we're not, you know, homophobic. We're not racist. We are the party of these quintessential Christian values. And in fact, I even worked for a bit on trying to get Governor Romney, now Senator Romney, elected president in 2008. I worked for years on that. And so I had so many conversations with my fellow Christians where I'd go to them and I'd say, yes, Governor Romney is a member of the LDS Church. This is not Orthodox Christianity, but he shares our values that we have stated. And they would look at me and they'd say, Nancy, I can't vote for him because I have, quote unquote, deeply held biblical beliefs. 5 minutes later, these same people, these same evangelical leaders were jumping on the Trump train. And it gave me so much spiritual and emotional whiplash. I almost was, you know, unable to process it. And then, you know, for the past 2 years, I've been investigating Kennecott camps in Branson. It ended up in USA Today. My investigation has been comprehensive, and that's a Christian camp. Then every time that I would talk to my sources, because of my never Trump stance, I'd have to convince them that I was Christian and that I was trustworthy. You know, and all I'm trying to do is help protect the children, their children. And for some reason, even if you talk about sex abuse, it's perceived to be a liberal issue. And it just cannot be the case, because Jesus was very clear about protecting the innocent and had some very harsh words about what happens when you lead children astray. In the Bible, it says that it would be better if you had a millstone tied around your neck and tossed in water than leading these children astray. And so it has to be a biblical value, just as other things are biblical values. And so the difficulty with being a Christian in the modern culture, and probably for all times, is that you have to accept all of the Bible and all of the teachings. And it doesn't allow you to neatly place yourself really in either political party, at least as they're, you know, currently constituted. And so we should approach the culture with grace and humility and without this sense of tribalism. But because the two-party system is the way it is, people have, you know, what happened was they decided, well, I'm going to hold my nose and vote for the lesser of two evils. But once you pull that trigger or write that name or push that button, something happens where in subsequent conversations culturally that happen on the news, you say, well, this is my person that's being attacked, or this is a person I voted for. And so even if you think you can, you know, maybe participate in that way and vote for someone, that vote actually means something. Mm-hmm. And it means something not only for the culture, but for you emotionally.
Such a great observation. Team sport politics has become such a powerful pull. It has become, the irony is, those who have decried identity politics for so long are often now addicted to their political identity. And, you know, your extensive writing career, Nancy, has also included, you've ghostwritten books with a number of high-profile American figures, including Sarah Palin. And a decade ago, you talked to Politico. You said it had been a positive experience getting to know the Palin family in private family settings, I mean, away from the noise, of course, of cable news and all the performative stuff. And what you saw was different, you know, loving. And I contrast this with what we heard, I mean, just in the last few days. It feels like everything is so performative now. CPAC was going on. And in the clip I want to listen to here, it's Sarah Palin talking to Steve Bannon. And they are discussing how unfairly Donald Trump is treated and how, in response, the federal government needs to really get more aggressive in trying to prosecute and jail Democrats. Let's listen.
Do it to its ultimate end and then hold people accountable.
Not only that, but we can't give up on the other corrupt acts that put our country in the position that we're in, like the 30,000 emails that were erased and, oh, that was okay, that crooked Hillary did that, Benghazi. Oh, my gosh, all these things were, oh, yeah, we're going to investigate. Congress should be having these bad, huge rallies on the steps of the Capitol, and it should be congressmen. They have the platform. They should be having these press conferences. They should even be having fireside chats. They should do whatever they can to get out there with a message to the public to let them know what's going on, right? I don't know why they don't seize the opportunity.
That just sounds like performance art for cable news to me. I don't know how that hits your ears, Nancy.
Well, you know, I've worked for so many. For a while, I only wrote for political leaders in the GOP. So I worked with just a vast number of people, including Sarah and even her daughter, Bristol. And I lived with them in Alaska for a month in the month of February, which was miserable in terms of the weather. But
yeah.
I love all my clients, and I appreciate all my clients, and I love the Palins. But at some point, and this was 2016, I was working for a bunch of these guys, and I realized that I could not go with them where they needed to go or where they were heading. And so, I mean, at one point I was literally at a Trump rally. My client was introducing, he had the speech before Trump. And, you know, they called me up there and they were like, hey, come up here and get a selfie with Trump. And I was like, I can't do this. I felt like it was some sort of like Sunday school lesson and peer pressure, but I definitely knew that I was not going to get a selfie with Trump. And I later ended up on his campaign plane. And I was like, this is not where I need to be. So I'm sort of confessing to you, I was very deeply ensconced in this world. I would go to Fox News and help my clients perfect their talking points before they went on TV. I wrote speeches. My spiritual gift was acrimony and owning the libs, although that's not listed in Corinthians as one of the spiritual gifts. I was very good at that. I grew up on Rush Limbaugh. I thought that back in the day, because I grew up loving President Reagan, that we were sort of teasing each other good-naturedly. If you recall, when Ronald Reagan was shot, his political adversary, Tip O'Neill, was one of the first people that came to his bedside and knelt beside him and said the 23rd Psalm. And I thought that's what I was engaging in, you know, like this sort of good-natured political jabbing and pugilism. But, you know, when it was all said and done, we were Americans and we loved each other. In 2016, everything started feeling darker. And I realized that that I needed to do something else, that, you know, honestly, I was part of the problem. And so I stepped aside from my role in all of these projects, which, by the way, I'm a college dropout. I don't have any other skills. You know, I used to work at the Huddle House and sell bicycles before I became a writer. And so when I took a step away, I didn't have anything else to back, you know, to fall back on. Since then, I've been able to write for some lovely people who are not in politics, and I'm going to write a book about my own life. I've just decided to do stuff differently. But I think what we need to remember is that this tribalism is so intense, but frequently it's because we're lonely. We don't have actual friends anymore. And when you don't have actual friends, you don't come face to face with your Democratic neighbors or your Republican neighbors. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to categorize people and stereotype them in a way. And so you might be lonely, but when you're watching Tucker Carlson on Fox News mock, you know, whoever the latest AOC gaffe, whatever that was, you think, well, you sort of get this sort of sense of warmth, like, well, I might not be able to talk about this with my friends, but at least Tucker and I hate the same people. And there's sort of a sense of belonging in that tribalism. And that's what I think the story of Kathy Kattenberg and the student at Williamson College taught me, is that people are just speaking out of deep pain and distrust. And a lot of times they don't even know the truth about the issues. And so journalism is very important, and talking about things, you know, with actual factual basis is super important. But what's mainly important is befriending each other and loving each other and talking to each other and having conversations in real life. Because if you've got an aunt who has started believing in conspiracy theories, when you ask her to leave, you're asking her to leave a lot of times her community, because, you know, she's involved in communities where she is celebrated and her views are appreciated. But just befriending people and talking to them and being able to talk honestly about the issues that, you know, plague us today in the context of real relationship, I think is the only way forward.
Nancy French, my guest, a New York Times bestselling author. You can read her work in various publications. And boy, I am way late for our only break. It's a short one. And I'm going to ask her on the other side of this break about something else that she's written about, which is their remarkable daughter, their adopted daughter, and some of the lessons and the conversations they've had. We'll also talk about why some of Nancy's writings about some other issues have brought to mind for me the way we are talking about Americans like Brittany Griner right now. So a lot to talk about in our remaining minutes with Nancy French in just a moment. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, Tom Golisano joins us. He has a new book out called The Italian Kid Did It, how I turned $3,000 into $44 billion and achieved the American dream. What Tom Golisano wants everyone to know about his story, coming up on Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The story of Nancy and David French's daughter is one that that David has talked about and written about, that Nancy has written about a bit. And I want to read a little bit of what you had to say there. Now, your daughter, by the way, is how old now?
She's 14.
14 now. So I think this one, she was 11. And this is what you wrote. You wrote, quote, "As the daughter of political writers, my 11-year-old sometimes hears adult conversations about tough topics. Earlier that day, she overheard President Trump had referred to immigrants from various African nations, Haiti, El Salvador, as people from blank hole countries. Since Naomi joined our family through an Ethiopian adoption, she was upset. When she saw the patriotic swimsuit later that day, she asked, is this okay to wear since we don't like Trump?" End quote. Can you describe how you navigated that moment as a parent, and how you navigate the question that people, that Americans may have in thinking about, you know, a president who describes maybe their own origin as in such vulgar or awful terms?
Well, I've always raised my kids to be patriotic, to love their country. David, my husband, is an Iraq War veteran. He earned a Bronze Star for his service. My dad is a Marine. We were at the gym and she was wearing that swimsuit. And one of the ladies was talking about that and in front of her. And it was a very difficult conversation. And I was so embarrassed to have to tell her that the country that she loved, you know, the country that she loves, her home country, she is an American, even though she comes from Ethiopia, is being led by someone who felt so disparagingly toward her country of origin. It was super embarrassing. And, you know, that prompted a lot of conversations with other people about, you know, it just feels personal. The whole Trump thing felt personal to me, because if the sexual predation wasn't a deal breaker, you know, Donald Trump at least entertained, retweeted, you know, racist people. He said things that were awful like that. Our process of adopting Naomi has been so eye-opening. It sort of changed my views, because I was able to see what it was like to live and to shop in affluent neighborhoods and to be followed by the security. Or we were at Nordstrom's and shopping for Christmas presents, and I was supposed to be Santa Claus. So I told Naomi to go stand in the accessories aisle so I could check out and buy her secret yoga pants. And by the time I checked out, a police officer had, talked to her and asked her what she was doing and whether or not she was stealing. And the police officer talked to me and even checked my bag for the yoga pants, you know, as if black children cannot have yoga pants, you know. So like, I sort of changed my views on that. But we got it from both the right and the left when I took her to GOP conferences back when I was a part of the GOP. We would get criticized online for cultural genocide because we were ideologically not teaching her the things that people thought we should teach her. And then after Trump rose to power, there was a surge of white nationalism and people started photoshopping Naomi's image into Auschwitz chambers with Donald Trump pulling the lever. And they said awful things online about her. It was almost like America sort of soured on international adoption, which is really, adoption is a really good thing. And it seems like all Americans should, you know, be able to support that. But the fringe on both right and left had a lot to say about our adoption.
Yeah. And I think about the way we talk about other people who might be different, whether it's an adopted child who comes from a different country, whether it's how, you know, a predominantly white congregation thinks about immigrants or black people, et cetera, or even the recent reaction I've seen to the story of Brittany Griner. Of course, the basketball star who is now detained and sentenced to 9 years in a Russian prison for having a small amount of medicinal marijuana. in her belongings. And, you know, some Christian leaders have called her a law-breaking ingrate, overly critical of her own country, who is now getting what she deserves in Russia. The implication that if people don't view our country exactly as we do or are exactly like us, that they deserve the most inhumane treatment. And what that brought to mind for me is this passage that you wrote in the Washington Post. You wrote, quote, "How should Christian Americans treat others? This is an important question in an age where our humanitarian crisis at the border is denigrated and mocked by evangelical Trump-supporting leaders. Jesus set a high standard when he said to do to others what you would have them do to you. This is more than a clever heuristic, but is a gauge by which we can determine our actions." End quote. Your own view of this seems clear-eyed and consistent, despite your own the leaders in the party that you used to belong to, enough that you decided that it was enough for you to not be there or to not participate or to not support. Whereas now a lot of those same Christian leaders and political leaders, I mean, they call Mitt Romney a sellout. They call Republicans who aren't lockstep, Adam Kinzinger, a sellout. And how do you pull a party back from that path? What is the path that you see forward here, Nancy?
You know, I honestly, it has to be love. We have to start loving each other. The fruit of the Spirit is not optional. So a lot of times Christians want to pick and choose what they want to spew out into the culture. But it is very clear in the scriptures that we do not have the choice to be, quote unquote, right on the issues and wrong in our practice of those issues or, you know, defense of those issues. We are called to be peaceful and kind and loving. And, you know, Jesus himself was crucified by people who should have, you know, loved him or at least didn't recognize him for what he was. We need to actually see each other for what we are. And we can't pick and choose. We have to be inundated with the Holy Spirit. And, you know, if you don't forgive others, you know, in the Bible, it says that you will be forgiven as you have forgiven others. That's a pretty chilling statement. Forgiveness is something that we have to really prioritize. And to the golden rule, it's golden for a reason. And we can't just set it aside and say, well, I'm ideologically correct, but behaviorally heretical. That is not an option open to Christians in America today.
Nancy, a little bit of feedback. Bob says, Evan, riveting interview with Nancy French. Thank you for this. Mark says, Nancy French for president. I don't know that a French is going to run for president. Nancy, there was a movement to get your husband to sign up for it. Should we expect that there will be no one named French from your household running for president?
Well, you know, I don't know. He might have a good idea. It might be the first college dropout president, so I think it's time for me.
Well, you know, the Ivy League has had its run. Andrew says that vote does mean something. I do not hold my nose and choose between the lesser of two evils offered by the two major parties. If I see a long shot that I admire, that person will get my vote. I may get a lot of flack from both sides, but I feel that I'm being honest to myself. That's from Andrew. Kathy says, Evan, interesting that your guest refers to the lesser of two evils in the last election as though Joe Biden's brand of Christianity doesn't count. Joe is probably a better Christian than many of the people you've been talking about, and it's a shame there is no recognition of that. That's from Kathy and Chile. How do you see that one, Nancy French?
Yeah, you know, actually I was referring to the 2016 options with Hillary and Trump, you know, Hillary who had committed felonies and Trump who had, we've already detailed his problems. I didn't mean to apply it to our current situation, so I must have misspoke.
Are you, do you have some affinity or appreciation for Joe Biden?
Oh, man, Joe Biden, I'm so thankful that we have an adult in the Oval Office today. I've been a Republican my entire life. But when Trump finally stepped down, quote unquote, to have someone who was in the office that you knew that he was not going to, spew racism, for one thing, let alone all the host of other things that Trump did, it was a relief. You know, Biden is not someone who represents my political values, but I'm very thankful for him and I pray for him.
Last comment from Charles, a conservative, who says, sorry, but I don't exactly feel an overwhelming urge to display empathy to people who routinely dismiss my concerns and insist that things I've experienced that inform my concerns never happen. Being civil hasn't resulted in the desired outcomes. So guess what? I don't care if someone's feelings get hurt now. That is from Charles. What would you say to Charles, Nancy?
I think civility is sort of like going to a steakhouse and ordering a salad. It does leave you sort of feeling empty. I'm calling us to something greater, which is love and actually seeing the people for what they are. And they're made in the image of God, even if they're sort of crazy. You know, I've done crazy things in my life and I sometimes have incorrect beliefs, but I hope that we can all as Americans sort of lock arms and see each other as fellow citizens and people who are worthy of respect and love.
Nancy French is a New York Times bestselling author. And when I reached out to her, I didn't even know that she would reply. She was gracious enough to give us an hour of her time. And I think we've learned this hour why her writing often does go viral when she writes in various publications, because it is the perspective of someone who is open to change and seeing the world with value and consistency, but also reevaluating where they are. And that's tough. That's not always easy to do. Nancy, I am grateful for this conversation, and I will continue to be a fan and a reader. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Nancy French, New York Times bestselling author. Hope you've appreciated the conversations during these 2 hours today on Connections from the whole team here. It includes Julie and Evan and Megan and Rob saying thanks for listening. Hope you're surrounded by love, and we're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.